The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Today, Barney Ronay. Who is he? What does he do? We'll find out everything. Barry, are you looking forward to it?
I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to probing Ronay's soul to find out what lies beneath.
Do you think Barney's looking forward to it?
I suspect he isn't. No, judging from, I think on Twitter yesterday, he thinks we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel, and who am I to disagree?
Now, exciting news that Premier League clubs can now have friendlies. They put out a few details, which makes it mean that Premier League footballers for the first time will have to be Sunday League footballers. Venues must be no more than 90 minutes away. So it's regional, amateur league. Players must travel in their own cars. Good. To and from fixtures while wearing the kit they play in, so the showers aren't working. Referees and assistants yet to be tested for COVID-19. So it's like the ref doesn't turn up and just a sub has to be the referee. And I've always wanted Premier League players to have to put up with what I put up with, putting up goal nets, players not turning up on time, dog shit on the pitch, having to pick it off. All those, you know, playing a late summer friendly, mosquitoes turning up with midges biting your legs with 30 minutes left. I think this is great news, and I think it'll help footballers become even more grounded, Barry.
One thing I've noticed about this, venues can be no more than 90 minutes away, and QPR and Norwich have arranged a friendly for next week, and I did the sums. Carrow Road and Loftus Road are 126 miles apart. The two clubs' training grounds are 139 miles apart, which means they can't play at any of those venues because players would be unable to drive there in time without breaking the speed limit. So it's sort of perfectly set for playing in the car park of the Linton Travel Tavern, which is famously equidistant between London and Norwich. Or else I checked the route and they could possibly get away with playing at Birchanger Green Services, which is on Junction 8 of the M11, if they play in the car park there. Otherwise, I'm not sure. I really hope they're not planning on breaking the rules.
Some brilliant tweets. I tweeted this out and just some brilliant ones going, you know, Jason says, no one will bring a ball to warm up with. Matt just shouting, has anyone got any tape? Jason saying, some people will have to park a few roads away because the car park hasn't been unlocked yet. Smithy says, who's got the bog roll? A familiar shout for five cubicles and only one bog roll. And James saying, imagine Arsenal. Quote, all right, lads, we've only got 10 for the first 15. Granite got in a scuffle last night, so he's running a little late after getting held up at the station. Keep it tight until he arrives. Thanks for all of those. And we'll get on with the pod now, Barry. And it will be the life and times of Barney Ronay. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, in which me and Barry will take a deep dive into the life and times of Barney Ronay. And to do that, we have Barney Ronay in front of us. How are you, Barney?
Yeah, I'm okay, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Do you think...
Could I just say that I would rather take a deep dive into the life and times of Barney Ronay behind his back if he wasn't here?
Well, Barry, I know that's the way it normally works. But I'd like to emphasise that I resisted this process for as long as was... It's like we really have run out of content, haven't we? It's like the bit in Spinal Tap where David St. Hubbins has left the band and they're playing a festival and they don't have any songs. So they end up playing a 25-minute jazz odyssey while people boo and throw bottles at them and do thumbs-down symbols. And they announce it with, I hope you enjoy our new direction. Well, that's what this is.
Is that the bit where they say that support band must have really sucked? They were still booing when we came on.
Yeah.
We've been quite surprised that listeners have enjoyed these looks into the souls of some of our contributors. Do you, Barney, like talk? And some of our contributors like talking about themselves. Do you like talking about yourself?
No, not at all. I mean, I really like Philippe one, because he actually has an interesting life and other talents and a kind of a hinterland and a kind of a beautiful, soulful way of talking about things. He's wise, funny, reflective. But that's those are rare qualities, as the next 20 minutes will demonstrate.
Mm. So let's start with young Barney. Barney, what is your first ever sporting memory?
Well, it's probably playing sport. I mean, I grew up in Southeast London. Lots of people had that thing of going to a game with their dad, and that's often how people get into football, particularly because it's a weakness passed on through the family. But that didn't happen with me because I grew up in a single parent family. It was just my mum who was an artist and not interested in sport. So I got into sport by playing it. I love playing football, and I was quite good at it as a kid. And that was the thing that sort of took me out of my house and into the world where these things happen. So I suppose the first game I remember, I started going to watch Charlton Athletic, who were the nearest team, with a friend of mine's parent and one of my friends and their parents. And I remember going to see a Manchester City away game at the Old Valley. And that's my first memory of sport. I remember that because it was the first time I'd ever seen a proper football crowd. Like, Man City brought thousands of people down in the old second division. And I remember Alex Williams was playing in goal for them. And I remember him running towards the fans and seeing this whole end erupt. People didn't wear colours in those days, but there was this real sense of like a mobile army and this big group of people just speaking to itself. I'm not mocking other people. There was a tendency in football crowds in the 80s to kind of celebrate yourself a bit. And I remember looking at that and thinking, wow, that is fucking cool. And that was my, weirdly, was Man City who got me into football. I just thought, this is brilliant, and I want to go to more of this.
You say you were quite good at football. When people say they were quite good, that can either mean they were hopeless or they were verging on international standard. Were you good, quite good, or bad, quite good?
No, I mean, I was only quite good in the sense that I was good enough to play in teams, which meant that I did stuff that I wouldn't otherwise have done and got into the whole world of sport. I was all right. I mean, I won some trophies with my schoolboy teams. We played in the Metropolitan Five-a-Side, where Ian Wright was the poster boy. He went to school just down the road, and they had this poster for years where they went and said, just get us the most skillful kid in any of these South London schools. We need a kid to do keep-ups. And there was this skinny little kid doing keep-ups on the poster, who then later turned out to be Ian Wright, and who became a bit of a massive hero amongst everyone who played that competition as a result, which was purely a piece of luck. But yeah, I was okay. I trained with Charlton. There weren't really academies in those days, but I played with the sort of Charlton 12 or 13-year-olds down near the Ferrier Estate in Thamesmead. And then I had a terrible accident where I ripped all the ligaments in my right knee, and I basically gave up sport for years and didn't play because it was such a painful injury, and I never really recovered from it.
Was that a football injury or something else?
No, Barry, it wasn't a football injury. It was a skiing injury, okay? I went too fast off the side of a mountain.
Barry, why are you laughing so much at the fact that Barney injured his knee skiing?
I honestly didn't know that. I thought, oh, he might have been a car accident or something, but it is a predictably middle-class injury, isn't it?
No, it's an injury that helps you with your preset agenda, the narrative that you wish to pursue, which many other people apart from me have also noted in your journalistic work, the need to have your confirmation bias confirmed about me. In fact, it's the one and only time I've ever been skiing, and it was with school. And yeah, it was pretty traumatic, but it's good that it confirms your prejudices.
Well, this is the thing. This is the thing. And this is why these things, I think, are quite interesting, because I only know of your background from Barry saying you have a footman and a cast of butlers and a sort of a Downton Abbey downstairs who bake all your bread and cook all your food. And so I just sort of presumed that you had some sort of aristocratic upbringing, but it sounds like you didn't really at all.
You do realise I don't really think he has a footman and a butler.
Well, I just kind of started to believe it.
No, actually, it's only funny because it's so far from the truth. I mean, I didn't grow up like that at all, and I mean, I grew up in South East London. I still live there. We were a single parent family, didn't have any cash. But I was one of Thatcher's kind of children. I got one of these state-approved scholarships, like a bursary, to go to a posh school when I was 11 from my primary school. So that's how I ended up going on a skiing trip and how I sort of, I ended up sort of talking with a different accent. I used to have quite a sort of very South London accent. And my life was kind of changed by that. And, you know, now I can be roundly mocked by Barry for having various things that I don't have, but would probably quite like to have. Sadly, don't. All I get is the mockery.
Did you always want to work in sport, or did you not know what you wanted to be or do when you were growing up?
Yeah, I didn't really know that you could work in sport. I mean, there was kind of sport in my family. My grandfather was a professional footballer in Austria, but I didn't really know him due to various sort of issues to do with Europe being in chaos. But there was a bit of sport, but it wasn't. I didn't know anyone who was in sport. I didn't know anyone in journalism. I didn't really know any adults with real jobs. Everyone I knew was kind of a hippie of some kind. And you got to remember, there wasn't really a sport media in this country until the mid-1990s in the way there is now. Football journalism was basically four or five red-faced men until the Premier League arrived and until Italia 90. And suddenly we had these sports desks with, you know, 50 people on them. We had loads of sport pages, loads of size reporting, loads of colour. And it was possible, there was this idea you could have a career in this was something new. So growing up, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. I just loved reading. I ended up doing an English degree. And that was about it, really. I didn't really think about careers at all. I didn't know you could actually work in journalism, really.
Owen writes, was Barney good at English at school? I'm an English teacher, and I often use Barney's columns as unseen texts for students to analyse and write about. He doesn't say whether he uses any of Barry's columns or mine, for that matter, as unseen texts. So you're always naturally good at English?
Yeah, I was just good at writing. You know, that was the one thing I was sort of good at. And I did, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but I loved the Guardian sports pages as a kid. I used to read David Lacey and Frank Keating, and all the writers were brilliant. And that was like my sort of secret world into sport. And I got to know all these guys and the way they wrote, and they became a kind of thing in my life. But I never sort of imagined you could do it. So, yeah, that's sort of what happened.
And you trained as a lawyer or a barrister?
Well, yeah, I finished university. I went to Oxford, where I didn't do very much at all. I actually played a lot of football there. Finally worked out in my final year I was supposed to work and try and get a degree. And then I just sort of left and basically played snooker for a year in the New Cross Inn and kept expecting something to happen. But things never happened, so I needed to earn some money and pay off some debts. So I managed to get a company to sponsor me to train as a lawyer, which was quite an experience. And I ended up practicing for 1 year in the city, well, in Westminster, helping to draft legislation and going to the House of Commons for lunch and things like that. But after a year of it, I just kind of, it's one of those things like in Macbeth, you can see, you're given this vision of exactly what you're going to become for the rest of your life. You can see in 5 years you'll be that guy, and in 10 years you'll be that guy. And I just kind of thought, there's not really any point in me doing this. Like, someone else could do it. It's I just couldn't really do it. I mean, it was a decision that has begun to make less and less sense as the people I knew at that time, fellow trainees, have all become QCs and partners, and are suddenly earning £1 million a year. But for a while, I was definitely winning by not doing it, just for a while.
But it's quite hard. I mean, there are lots of people who don't know what to do and then go into a job that they don't particularly like and then feel trapped there. It's not an easy decision to get off any kind of train that is moving and to retrain. How did you do that?
I just felt I didn't have anything to lose. I was sort of, it's one of those things where you just think, I can't go on doing this anymore. It was making me feel pretty bad. So I stopped and thought there must be something better than this. And I gave myself 6 months to, I've got to find something else in 6 months, or I'm just going to run out of money. I won't have anywhere to live. I'll be on the streets. And then within about I was just really lucky. I actually saw a job advert in The Guardian, weirdly enough, for the ITV Digital was starting. Do you remember when ITV Digital started? There's adverts everywhere, 2001, with like Des Lynam saying, this is the new football, the future of football is ITV. ITV, there's going to be a new ITV Premiership era. And they were starting a website, and I just applied for a job on it as a kind of website writer and was lucky enough to get it. And that was it. I was sort of had a foot in the door from there.
What was the first proper thing you did in sports journalism then?
Well, around that time, I started working for When Saturday Comes magazine, who were, you know, still one of my favourite things and my favourite group of people. They're sort of the first real mass, still the only independent football magazine. Take pieces from fans, always, it was basically sort of sprung out of the kind of punk fanzine movement by a guy called Mike Titcher, who still works for The Guardian in Australia. And they gave me a chance to write a bit of stuff. I started going into the office to do bits and bobs on the magazine. And it was a really, really good education at a place that I would still encourage anyone wanting to get on in journalism to send things into. They will read your work, they will look at it, and they will publish it if it's any good. Andy Lyons is the editor, and still. And I still think it's the best thing, because they'll give you a really honest appraisal. And if your work's good enough, they'll publish it. And so When Saturday Comes was a really, really good sort of grounding for me, how to write about stuff, about the idea that football is something for fans, for supporters primarily, rather than broadcasters or players or all the other interests. And that was kind of a formative experience for me.
And did you find it easy straight away, or did you, you know, like Robbie Savage, have to work at your game? Or because a lot of people have asked questions about your writing style. You know, Simon says, does Barney dream in similes? Yogi says, does Barney ever laugh, snort, parp, honk out loud when he's writing in full flow? Did it come very naturally to you?
I mean, I just used to read a lot of books. I always read a lot. And I sort of wanted to be sort of a writer, really, rather than a football journalist. But sort of ended up doing football because I had these two interests. And it's just one style. There's loads of people out there who I think are really good football writers, and who I read just because you get a really good mix of both being very informed and being able to write well. So there are people like that who are...
Like who, Barony?
I suppose I'd always read Sam Wallace, who I think is really good, who writes in a really entertaining way, but actually has a hell of a large knowledge about football as well. Yeah, there's loads of people. I mean, you, Barry, obviously... Jonathan Liu, who is now our colleague, is brilliant. Rory Smith's really good. But not just people from broadsheets newspapers. There's lots of people who have totally different skills to me, who I think are brilliant, who understand how hard news works and will actually give you information. So I think we're lucky to have lots of brilliant writers. And if you want one thing, you can come and read my kind of stuff. Or if you want other... stuff with slightly more news depth or a little bit more inside information, you can go there. There's a lot to read. People always endlessly moan about the media in this country, but I think if you like football, pretty good, you know.
What's the work you're most proud of? Nigel Adley, the commentator, sent a question saying, you know, is the Millwall stuff you did the stuff you're most proud of? What would you say?
In one way. I mean, that was really different. That was something where I went back to being a lawyer in a way, and I was just trawling through endless official documents, financial documents, council planning documents, and use this entirely different set of skills to the usual kind of writing a flowery piece of work. And it was absolutely fascinating, I have to say. There were so many connections in that thing. There was so much stuff that didn't get published. I met so many interesting people. There's a fascinating kind of film in it or a book in it at some point. That was really interesting and a very sort of strange period in many ways. We ended up getting very involved in the political side of it, which was most unexpected. I was pretty proud of that. But I'm also proud of some of the things that I wrote, which I think are good. And sometimes I look back and think, my God, how on earth did I get away with writing that crap? There's actually a bit that Jonathan Wilson always takes the mickey out of me, where I compare Jonathan Trott to a badger in a waistcoat. For some reason, it just seemed like a good way of feeling something.
An anthropomorphic badger in a waistcoat with a talent for growing tomatoes was the line.
Yeah. I look back at the article the other day, and I went through it. I went through the England batting order in it. This was years ago. And in it, I described how each of the players made you feel, their stage in your life. So you go from the kind of excitement of being an opener and being everything so clear and pristine to being a tail ender where you're kind of running out of energy and dying. And you know, Stuart Broad's attempts to bat are like your elderly relative's attempts to master new technology, completely baffled. And the last line is, James Anderson's reverse sweep is the last erection you'll ever have.
Oh, no.
And I read that and just held my head in my hands and thought, how was that published? I mean, it's just a dreadful thing that you might possibly think but shouldn't actually end up in the paper. So there are moments like that, right? I kind of feel bad and think maybe I went too far.
Do you have sort of a one method for writing a column, or just sometimes, you know, you just sit there and you just write it in one go in an hour and it's easy, and other times you're there for hours and hours and hours?
Please bear in mind that as soon as we finish recording this podcast, I have to fill the very well, metaphorically very big stilettos of razor sharp stilettos of marine hide, so I'm going to listen to this answer with a lot of interest.
Well, you'll probably be disappointed then, because I mean, I have no idea, but I think there are two. I think most people say there's two ways it happens. Where if there's something you really believe in quite strongly, and where there's something you just really want to say that you think needs to be said about an issue, it tends to just come straight out of the hand. You just write it instantly. Whereas when there are aspects of nuance, or you know, quite often you just have to write a column. It can take forever, and you end up writing around it and editing down some huge amount of floppy sort of crap. But when those moments where there's something you really, where the calendar necessity to actually write something flukishly intersects with the idea that there's actually something worth writing about, then it tends to come out really quickly and to actually be good as well. But on the other hand, the ability to just do it and keep doing it, even when you don't have that feeling, is probably what distinguishes being able to do this professionally from being a very good writer who might do it in your spare time.
Yeah, I think, Barry, you've mentioned that, haven't you? That quite a lot of quite famous people have had that back page on The Guardian and have gone, I've got a Guardian column and this is great. And after 4 weeks have gone, I've got to write another one.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of what happened with Russell Brand, and I wouldn't imagine... I don't think Darrow Breen would mind saying that he was very chuffed to get a Guardian column. But then once the novelty had worn off and he was sort of writing it in the back of his tour car on a Friday afternoon, desperately trying to think of something to write 800 words on. The thing is, if you're someone like Russell Brand or Darrow Breen and you're earning, I don't know, tens of thousands of pounds a night on tour, the amount of money you get paid for a Guardian column by comparison is peanuts, and it probably doesn't take them long to realise it's not worth the hassle and aggravation involved. I should add, I did enjoy the columns written by both comedians I've mentioned.
It's all right, Barry, you don't need to suck up to them. Russell Brand was my immediate predecessor on the Guardian back page, and his columns were really good at the start. I thought they were really funny. He used to just be a real sort of filthy kind of bloke who just, you know, told you about his interesting low life. But he's gone through this period of becoming inspirational, hasn't he? And I think that coincided with his Guardian columns kind of dropping off a cliff. They very quickly just became this kind of totally empty space. I remember the subs kind of holding their head in their hands when they came in saying, What do we do with this? It was extraordinary. Like, I think he started dictating them in the back of a cab onto something else, and it was a strange moment where we'd get them with 20 minutes to go, and some poor, extremely experienced, skillful sub would try to make Russell's kind of meanderings into an actual newspaper column, and in the end, yeah, it just became, there was like nothing there. It just became unsustainable. But he was very good at the start, I have to say.
Can I ask about writing books, Barney? Because they seem like a lot of effort, and you've written, is it four? How many have you written?
Yeah, I've written a few books. I mean, I find books really difficult as well. Some people have a natural kind of rhythm for that. But the last one I wrote was about the World Cup in 2018, just sort of traveling around Russia. And that was fun because it was kind of a travelogue. It was kind of reportage. but they are very difficult. And there's something that a good book will be something you have to fight to get published generally. It's something you really believe in. Every single book I've written so far has been a book that's basically been brought to me by a publisher with an idea. And it's kind of a job. It's like a journalistic job. So I'm not particularly proud of any of them, to be honest. I've never had the gumption to have a really good idea and say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take rejection. I'm going to see it. And those are always the best books. Those are always the best bits of anything anyone ever creates. When you just say, I'm not going to take rejection. I'm going to stick at this. This is my idea. And those end up being great books or great sitcoms or whatever. And I can't claim to have ever done anything like that. I'd say most of my books are hack work.
Have you ever been tempted to perhaps take a really intensive look at the tactics of Hungarian football in the 30s and put that into a book?
Well, that is an example, in fact. I mean, that's something Wilson really interested in. And obviously, much of it is, although he'd never say this, effectively a homage to me and to my background and my family, which is really nice. And he doesn't need to say that, it's understood. But that kind of thing, you know, I admire him for doing that, but I've never quite had the balls to do that.
Has your relationship with sport changed working in it? I mean, does the magic go? I was thinking specifically about those 3 days last season when, I don't know if you went to all these games, but, you know, Vincent Kompany scored that 25-yarder to basically give City the title. Then Liverpool beat Barcelona 4-0. Then Spurs won in Ajax. And from an armchair fan sitting on the sofa, it was like the most amazing 3 days of football. But for those journalists who are at each of those games, the travel, having to write, travel again, write, being away from home, I wonder if that takes the magic away, even though you're in this amazingly privileged position to have seen three amazing moments.
Yeah, I mean, that was incredible. That was different because that was, that was just a relentless adrenaline high. It was brilliant. Probably the most intense 3 days, more intense than a tournament. And every single game went to the last second, the last twist, and that was just brilliantly enjoyable. It was exhausting, and for about a week after that, I felt terrible. But it's more the weekly grind of it that can be kind of get you down. But then. I love being at the events. Being at the events is just something you never lose. And I'll probably will be one of those really old guys still going and doing this because there's nothing quite like it. That's the bit you get addicted to. And I like being around the people. There's a very nice kind of spirit among sports journalists, which you don't often see, where people are good colleagues from other newspapers, from other outlets. People look after each other a bit. People are friendly. There's a camaraderie with people you don't really know that well, but you might see year on year on year. And it's a fantastic job. And, you know, anyone who's thinking of getting into it, it is difficult. It's very hard to see a way in, but it's not impossible. And it is rewarding and fun. And when you're in it in that moment, sort of unlike anything else.
If you could pick a game or a tournament above any other, is that possible?
Yeah. I mean, some of them just sort of stand out that you really enjoy being at. For some reason, I always think back to Euro 2008 and Croatia 2, Germany 3 in Klagenfurt, which probably isn't the game most people think of. But I loved that tournament. It was the first big tournament I've been to. Croatia won that game were fantastic. The pitch, you were really close to the action. You could see Luka Modric, all of that incredible Croatian front three, really close up. You could see them making Germany run. You could see this feeling of one team asserting itself over the other one. That was fantastic. And it was slightly wild in Klagenfurt after that. There was this weird feeling on the streets. It's a strange place. And it was just a kind of amazing sort of night. And most recently, similar sort of thing, I loved going to Spain versus Russia at the World Cup in 2018 for different reasons. That was the game that just went on forever, where Spain just had the ball constantly, but you knew somehow they were going to lose. And I was sat there with Sid in the stands. We were both, for some reason, we were not that well. I think we were really hungover. We were drinking Diet Coke and just sort of talking to each other and saying, oh my God, this is just going to go on forever, forever. Just hypnotized by Spain passing the ball around. But somehow we got through it and had to file on the whistle and in extra time and on the final whistle. And somehow we both produced out of it articles that we're really proud of, that were basically just an extension of the conversation we'd had for about 2 hours. And I just really enjoyed that. It was really good fun.
Can I ask, Barney, say Champions League night, so you're on a very tight deadline, you're the sidebar colour king, so you have to file maybe 10, 15 minutes before the end of the game. You're obviously given an idea of what to write about, which is clearly subject to change if anything extraordinary happens in the game or someone has a particularly good or bad game. Do you go in with stuff prepared? Are you good at writing under pressure? Or are you like me? Do you go into a total panic and sort of forget basic English as you watch the clock tick down and the cursor blink in the corner of the screen?
It is quite a weird thing to do. I mean, in case people, you know, just to explain it, it's probably quite boring, but basically you're just told to file 900 words by 9:30 in a game that finishes at 9:40. That's the only real guidance. And it can't be a match report. It's got to be on a theme. It's got to be about something. So often you're filing this piece before the game is finished, having written it while half watching it. And by that stage, panic kind of sets in. The only thought is this has to be some coherent sentences that can be in the newspaper and look okay. And that's basically the skill. You just have to be able to file that and to send something that looks like a football report. We're still on these kind of slightly absurd deadlines. But if you're late and they can't send the page or it gets delayed, it costs thousands of pounds. So that kind of fear kicks in and you end up just forcing yourself to do it on this sort of adrenal rush of Haribo and coffee and just kind of throwing in anything you can. And that the weird thing is that edition of the paper basically really only goes to the outer parts of the, it'll go online and then go to like Cornwall. And you know, Paul Hayward always sort of once said to me, they must think football journalists are ridiculous in Cornwall. They must look at it and think, like, this bloke's an idiot. Like, he doesn't even know the score. Like, but if you're in Cornwall, don't bother reading the football reports, because what you've got there is the inner workings of someone's crazed, panic-stricken mind, just trying to keep their job by not delaying the page going. So, but then after you've sent the kind of madness to the people in Cornwall, and which often goes up on the web as well, you get, I don't know, half an hour to rewrite. And that's really the skill, you know, that people often say, well, you've missed this, or you didn't fully analyse that thing to do with VAR, or, you know, maybe you've got the wrong guy doing the assist. But the fact is, you're just in a panic. Often there's no replay. You just have to file something 10 minutes before the game finishes. And that's the skill, you know, enjoy it. It's a feat of people getting things on a page, basically.
Can I ask, Barney, if you had to choose between only being able to write about football for the rest of your career or only being able to write about cricket, which would you pick?
Well, I mean, it'd probably be cricket, but although I think probably football's the more sensible choice. Writing about cricket is different. It's kind of, you get a long time to do it. They give you lots of really nice food. It's incredibly restful in the press boxes. And, you know, I love the game. It's got so much depth to it. It's a very different thing. It might not have the kind of big emotional notes of football all the time, or be quite a sort of thrilling in the moment. It's more of a slow burn thing. It's more of a sort of literary experience, cricket. But I mean, cricket journalists, they travel constantly. I wouldn't like to. I think I could handle that. There's a lot of. It's a very tight knit bunch because they're away together all the time. But a nice sort of dip into that world, but. It's kind of a fascinating world.
It is. And in my limited experience of covering both football and cricket broadcasting, the cricket commentary box is a totally amazing thing where you're just sort of sitting there chatting away to something absolute, Mike Hussey, some legend of the game, and then another legend of the game like Farouk Engineer will just sort of wander in and go, is it my turn? And someone says, half an hour, Farouk. And he goes, very good. And then you go back, you go into another room and Sunil Gavaskar is having a nap. And the whole thing is, and the food, you're right, Barney, is ridiculous. And compared to the intensity of football, it's a totally different thing. But I guess a cricket commentary, that whole area is exactly, I think, what I hoped it would be.
It's like a sitcom. You know, they say the best sitcom is where the characters can't escape. Like, there's nowhere to go. You can't stop being a rag and bone man. You can't. No one can leave. You're stuck. You're in prison. It's porridge. Well, cricket's like that. No one can escape from it. The people in cricket are totally stuck in cricket. Their whole life. I always used to talk to Mike Selvey when he was in the press box, and every reference he had, everyone he knows is an. I'll sort of mention something. Oh, do you remember Alan Lamb doing this 30 years ago? And he'd be like, oh, yeah, I saw Lammy last night at a barbecue. Like, everyone he knows is a famous cricketer from the 1980s. His whole life, there is nothing else. It's this total lifestyle that just consumes them. I don't think football's quite that. I think people escape from it at times. They're often out of necessity, but it's a strange world.
We had a few questions from listeners. Richard said, who is or was Barney's favourite footballer to watch? Not necessarily the best, just favourite.
Well, it's a fairly sort of cliched answer. I suppose growing up or when I was younger, I loved watching Gascoigne. He was the first footballer who just absolutely thought, wow, this guy is just amazing. He made you laugh, the thing he did on the pitch. And you could see that there was something about him that just didn't fit into the standard human template, just the way he spoke, the way he did stuff. I was watching the Gazza documentary the other day. There's a relatively new one, and there was a detail I'd missed. You know, when he fouls, I can't remember which player it is, to get his second booking in the 1990 semi-final. And he goes through him. He says he didn't touch him at all. And there's the thing about him crying and blah, blah, blah. Well, he pointed out that actually he was really annoyed because the player was screaming on the floor. And Gazza said, I was really annoyed. He was screaming. I hadn't touched him. He just wanted to get me booked. So I went up to him and put my hand in his mouth and grabbed his tongue to stop him screaming so the ref wouldn't come over. And they replayed it. And you can see Gazza putting his hand in this guy's mouth, trying to grab his tongue to stop him from screaming. And he's sort of laughing about it. And you just think, like, who does that? It's just such a funny thing to do. But I loved watching him, you know, head up, just sort of running around saying, this is a game I can just take control of. I suppose probably now my favorite player is probably Riyad Mahrez, just because similarly he always makes me laugh whenever I see him. He's like a mime artist or something. The things he does are hilarious and entirely his. He's made up this series of physical movements which fool these professional athletes again and again, and I find him completely mesmeric to watch and just really fun.
A couple of threads of questions. We had a lot of questions on this subject. Craig, what is currently the longest running witch's curse? Mitchell, Tottenham Hotspur haven't played in their new stadium for months now. Another sign of the witch's curse. And Matt, at what point in his life did the magic die and Barney stop believing in the power of the witch's curse? Rigoberto saying it remains the Barney v Barry witch's curse discourse, a high watermark for Football Weekly Mac 2.0.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that probably was quite an interesting thing in a way, and that why was I going on about witches? I think it's that idea that...
I think you were taking the piss out of me, but actually I would go so far as to say you were bullying me.
Maybe I think I was imputing something to you that you didn't actually believe because I was annoyed with that thing, but then I refused to accept that you didn't actually believe it anyway on a point of principle. But it's this idea, I suppose, it's the lack of analysis, the kind of, oh, you know, there's what's wrong with, you know, Spurs? They're bottlers and that kind of thing. When in fact, at that stage, I think they'd probably simply not bought any players. You know, that team was in the stage of, in the process of dying and not renewing itself. And the issue was, you know, a lack of management of the team. And so the constant talk about what's wrong with this team, it just really annoyed me as a kind of non-forensic way of looking at things. And then Barry started ranting on about a witch's curse, which he seemed obsessed with, and still to this day maintains is the issue here. And I snapped finally after, you know, years of this.
I was, just while Barry was talking there, I was racking my brains because I couldn't remember what the witch's curse was. It wasn't specifically to do with Tottenham's inability to win semi-finals or something.
Yeah, oh, they tend to lose to the team which has eerily spent £200,000 more on players and who tends to be the team who's also going for this final stage of a tournament or a league. You know, I just felt that we could probably analyse it in slightly in a colder light than simply dwelling on your absolute ongoing obsession with witches' curses.
How did your subsequent hearing with human resources go? I note you're still employed by the Guardian. Did you at least get an official written warning about your bullying behaviour?
Well, if I mention witches' curses again on a Football Weekly show, I'm apparently out of the building. But this will all be edited out, won't it?
Yeah,
sure. Yeah. There is one other. There was quite a long-running contest as to who is the most misanthropic panellist out of Barry Glendenning, Barney Ronay and Jonathan Wilson. But quite a lot of questions, Barney, came in this way. The DOS box, what drove the change to his Guardian profile pic from young T-shirt-wearing Barney to tired, jaded Barney? SHL, how can someone so miserable on the pod yet be so funny in their columns? And Simon, why did Barney get 10 times more miserable once the Guardian updated his headshot?
I mean, the story of that headshot update incident is that I refused. I never go in the office. Periodically I'd be pestered to update the pic. That one was from something like 2002, the initial one. And it just kept going forever for years. And I kind of quite enjoyed the fact it was still there. And then finally they kind of collared me on some morning about whatever it was 3 years ago. And there I am staring out resentfully into the camera, the most miserable looking kind of collared, I really want to go person being told to do this by a photographer. But I think I was probably at something of a physical low at that moment. It doesn't represent, it's not a snapshot of a happy time. I like to think I've probably got slightly younger and more cheerful since that picture was taken. I might update it again with a kind of cheeky grin and try and restage the photo.
The most angry I've ever seen Jonathan Wilson, his temper was basically inflamed at having to get a new Guardian mugshot taken. It's quite a stressful ordeal, and it shouldn't be, but it really is.
I remember this. Yeah, there was some sort of altercation, wasn't there?
Mine is still from 2008, and I'm happy to occasionally see myself with completely different colour hair. I'm sticking with it for the whenever I do a what I did on my summer holidays article, as Barry calls them. Steve says, often wondered who the hardest Football Weekly contributor is, not in a knobhead way or out, more if it all kicked off at a post-live show pints in Reykjavik, say. Who would you want to step behind you? Always thought Ronne or Doyle.
I mean, you're hardly choosing from a particularly elevated kind of pantheon of noted hard men. Who's the hardest Guardian Football Weekly contributor? If it's between me and Doyle, it's definitely Doyle. I'd walk away from that contest.
You could out-simile the hardest of hard man, Barney, and hope that they would run
away. I don't
away
know, yeah. It's a pretty tough school, those underground bare-knuckle simile contests around the den, in the arches around the den. I wouldn't start shouting your mouth off, Max. You know, you'll get a challenge.
In that sort of athletic beginning, I think they came in for you, Barney. Big money offer, huge glitzy contract, and you turned them down for the humble old school newspaper that it is, The Guardian. Why did you do that?
Yeah, that's a tough question, Max. Well, it's true. I did go and meet them. I met the people who founded it, and I like them, and I know the editor and various people involved, and there's lots of people who write for them who I like. But I guess in the end I wanted to write for a newspaper, and I found their model pretty hostile towards newspaper. I like I want to be in the same thing as something which is writing about things happening in the world, not just football. I want to be in the same paper as Marina Hyde and Gary Young and whoever else is good out there. You know, I like those people. I like reading them. And I also had a slight problem with the model. I was slightly troubled by the model, I guess. Subscription is undoubtedly the future. And some people do this really well. But I just slightly struggle with the idea of how you, I guess, write about clubs when that club's fan base is your audience. And subscriptions are everything. And those people might not always want to hear everything you've got to write about their club. You might write things that they disagree with or dislike, or which make you public enemy number one. Well, you're simply not going to survive. So you kind of have to preach to a certain kind of line if you want to be successful in that job. And I just couldn't quite see how that would fit the way I like to write about things. My Man City piece, for example, might not be one that the subscribers really, really go for. But I'd still like to write it. So yeah, it probably wasn't for me.
Finally, Lorenzo says, what is the worst thing, brackets, things, about working with Max and Barry?
Well, there are no bad things. The one thing about Football Weekly and The Guardian is actually... The Guardian's like a Stalinist bureaucracy. It can be incredibly frustrating. Just to get on this call, we had to do all these tech things, and there are loads of people involved, and loads of decisions, no doubt, had to be made. It can drive you mad. But the actual people are really nice. And I've never known anyone in our office or on this show who's had a big ego or been, you know, look at me or this or that. And it's actually a good place. So, no, I have no complaints.
That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up the rest of the news. We'll look at football's reaction to the protests in the United States. And Barney will tell us off as well. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's begin with football's reaction to the death of George Floyd and the protests in the US and across the world. It's important to say that 6 months ago or so, you'll remember we did a special pod in the aftermath of the racism that England players were subjected to in Bulgaria. We were planning to do a follow-up to that 6 months on before the pandemic hit, and we still want to do it. We just want to do it properly and well and do the subject justice. Since the death of George Floyd, some footballers have come out and some football clubs have come out with Blackout Tuesday and Black Lives Matter on social media. The chairman of Kick It Out has urged every Premier League footballer to take a knee when the season resumes in the protest against the killing of George Floyd by the police in Minneapolis, adding that the Football Association should not punish players who use their platforms to call for social change. FIFA released a statement saying it's up to competition organisers to decide whether to sanction players for protest messages, but urging them to use common sense and have in consideration the context surrounding the events. Johnny Liu's done a piece which he says sports teams and organisations are not uniquely culpable for the deep well of injustice that led to Floyd's death last Monday. They're not uniquely responsible for the restitution, but many inspire a loyalty and identity that most companies can never hope to match. People will follow if only they would lead. And it's been interesting, hasn't it, that there is a disconnect between what a lot of sports franchises and clubs have said in the past week to their actions. If you look at US soccer, tweeting one nation, one team this week, but in 2017, passing a rule mandating players to stand for the national anthem in reaction to Megan Rapinoe protesting police brutality and kneeling in solidarity. Leeds United tweeting hashtag Blackout Tuesday yesterday. Still, Jonathan Lecco is waiting for an apology from Kiko Casilla. He was banned for 8 matches and fined £60,000 for racially abusing Lecco while he was playing for Charlton. Manchester United tweeted red against racism. In 2016, Ed Glazer donated $98,000 to Donald Trump's election campaign and £250,000 to his inauguration. I mean, I'm picking out these clubs, I could pick out a whole selection.
It's interesting, but it's unsurprising, and it's not strictly reserved to football. There's lots of corporations have done the Blackout Tuesday thing and been called out for their hypocrisy. I always feel slightly uncomfortable talking about racism on the podcast. We were discussing this yesterday, Max, because I'm not sure, as a middle-aged white bloke who didn't really know any black people until I came to London when I was 26 or 7 years old, I'm not sure what meaningful contribution I can make to the debate. And it's a very one-sided debate. Racism is bad, and anyone who disagrees with that doesn't really have a leg to stand on. I noticed yesterday West Brom did the Blackout Tuesday thing, and one of their fans replied saying, cancel my season ticket. He didn't agree that they should be doing that. This was on Twitter, and they replied to him saying, you won't be missed. And, he dug in. He took on all comers and started criticising people's appearances and weight. And you're just going, what are you doing, man? Just stop digging. It was a silly thing to say in the first place. Why are you doubling down, trebling down, quadrupling down? Musa and Ryan, who were friends of the show on their Stadio podcast, I've listened to the opening 20 minutes of their most recent pod twice, and it is well worth a listen to get Musa's point of view. He's been quite vocal in various news outlets about this, and Johnny Liu's article was brilliant.
Simon Cooper from the FT tweeted yesterday, I've been writing about football and politics for 30 years. I can't remember a time when so many footballers have made political statements. I'm impressed. I mean, I don't know, Barney, if there's any, you know, if we feel, and we've said it before, is this the moment for change, etc.? This could be the moment, or will we be back here again in a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, it depends what change you're talking about. I mean, I've been really impressed by the way young footballers are. We're so used to sport, refusing to engage with politics. But people like Jadon Sancho, his message was tweeted by FIFA's official account. They put a picture up of his T-shirt. I mean, that's that, and then took it down fairly quickly afterwards. But that's, whatever, 3 million people. That's the way to use your platform. And I'm impressed by the fact that these young men and women are fearless in criticizing things they see and feel and have experienced, which is not something that's always been the case. So that will definitely help change. But it's interesting what Barry says. And there is a sort of tension between feeling, if you are a white person commenting on racism towards black people, that you want to try and express that you also feel bad about this, that, and you want it to change and not happen. But you also don't want to try and express that in a way that suggests you have the answer or you are the person to listen to on this. And what Barry said there about listening was, I think he said, I've got nothing to say about this, but I thought he made a very good point about listening to other people and learning and acting on what they say. That's something you can do. I mean, I grew up in a different sort of situation. I grew up in London in the 80s, where there was a lot of overt racism, which there still is, which I've seen coming back, actually. And in those days, it was fairly simple that racism was basically either really terrible things or things that felt not terrible. So someone would be, there would be overt racism. We had national front marches through Lewisham. And if you stood against that, that was enough. If you just said, this is, I don't support this, I'm going to stand against it, I'm going to be on the other side, that was enough. But obviously, once you get past the fact that, I mean, sadly, that overt racism is coming back, and I know that from people who live around here. I speak to you can once again be racially abused just walking down the street, but there's so many more layers to it and levels to it that I think people of my generation have to really try to understand and to sympathize with and to work to break down. It's not simply saying I don't like racism and overt expressions of racism are wrong. And frankly, when something like an organization like FIFA or like you say, lots of these corporate organizations speak out against racism, my feeling is the same. It's like, spare me. This is much more complicated than simply expressing on a very basic level that, you know, it's now become appropriate and useful for your brand to express this particular message. I mean, on a very simple level, I was in Bulgaria when, yeah, that was old school racism expressed towards England players. And not just from people in the crowd, from people in the press room, from the Bulgarian FA members. Nothing happened. There was no overt censure of that. Bulgaria is still playing. That would have been really substantial action rather than a statement offhand from Gianni Infantino when it's suddenly the movement's gone the other way and it's now appropriate to say this. Think about an alien looking at this, like the colour of your skin, like what colour you are is literally a factor in our society, and people have decreased life choices, have less chance to express their talent based literally on the colour they are. I mean, it's so absurd. And what you have to remember is that you are affected by it as a white person because your society is worse. That sounds wrong. You're not obviously not as personally affected by it as the people who are directly subject to this. But if you're struggling to kind of feel that you can help because all our entire society is going to be better if this doesn't happen. So much unhappiness is created, so much talent is lost, so many people who should be doing things and have opportunities don't receive those opportunities, and that's a huge lag in our society that everybody should be trying to battle against, and it affects everyone, not just the people who are directly disadvantaged. Everybody should be working to stop this happening because we all benefit from it. There's not finite resources that we can't possibly spread out. You know, there's huge human potential out there that deserves the same right as everyone else to be expressed, and we all benefit from that.
I would exactly echo what Barry said at the top of this. If you want to hear a sort of measured, thoughtful and really passionate 20 minutes on this, the Start of Stadio podcast was brilliant, I thought. I wanted to talk to you, Barney, about Newcastle United. We did a pod last week about it. It's the proposed takeovers now, and it's 8th week. Still to decide on the outcome of the owners and directors test. The World Trade Organization's report on BOUTQ is due to be released on the 15th of June. Barry, we got lots of praise on this subject. Owen said a brilliant discussion on the Toon takeover in Thursday's pod. Mature, nuanced, well-informed. Would love to see the pod giving that much time to big, complex issues like this a few times a season. Thank you. Nick Cohen of The Guardian saying, genuinely serious discussion of the Saudi regime's takeover of Newcastle United. Fans' point of view very well put, but also the argument that because so much else MBS touches turns to dirt, he may not be NUFC's saviour. It was excellent. One man was not impressed, Barry, and that man was Barney Ronne, and said, well, Barney, you can tell us what you didn't like about it.
Well, I mean, I think that's slightly overstating the case. I thought it was very interesting, and I thought it was very interesting to hear the view of, you know, Newcastle fans who are caught in the middle of this and are being asked to form an opinion on something and to be sort of standard bearers for an ideology they might not share or care about or feel they're empowered enough to take a stance on the things that Saudi Arabia does. And that was very well articulated, I thought. I suppose what you're referring to is our private conversation afterwards, where I expressed a few thoughts to you, which you've now parlayed into a public forum, which is fine. There are just some things where I don't get it, basically. I'm sure it's my fault, but I just can't really understand the logic exactly. I suppose the basic thing is the talk about being so excited about getting rid of Mike Ashley. And so uniformly excited. I'm actually a bad person. We heard that lots of Newcastle fans actually disengaged from the club and were put off from going because of the way Mike Ashley treated Kevin Keegan, that this was seen as, you know, really bad form. It was not nice. It was inhumane in some way, the way he treated Kevin Keegan. But they're very excited about being owned by Mohammed bin Salman in the next breath, which I really struggle with that. And it seemed to sort of go slightly unchallenged. It's this idea that there are fans who stop buying season tickets to show their displeasure at Ashley. But when it comes to Saudi, we're what can we do? We're powerless. There's nothing. It's just this thing that somehow the idea that this person is going to throw loads of money at your football team and run it like a dream. They're gonna buy you the striker you always wanted to see. Because it's in their interest to do that, because they've bought the club in order to make people happy and like them. That's just okay. It doesn't mean you. Obviously, Mike Ashley was an entirely different kettle of fish. But if there was anyone in the world who was going to come and own something I care about and really think, I suppose it comes from this idea of football clubs as being part of the community, of being a really valuable thing that you care about, and which has some value that goes beyond anything else in your life. The idea that was going to be owned by someone who's deliberately using your club to put on a public face to the world because they're aware that currently there's a lot of bad publicity around some really quite bloodthirsty things that they've done, that would bother me. I just can't understand celebrating that. I just don't get it. And I'm sure that's me. I just haven't quite got it. I would like to see the idea that a nation state owns a football club for essentially PR reasons. They're not buying it as an investment. I'd like to see people saying we don't want this to happen in the same way that's the case in Germany. So I don't think this is what football is.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And actually, I really appreciated what you said, because I think when you do a pod like that, you are not, you know, it's not, oh, here are some games, let's chat about it, have a nice time. You want to do it properly. And I think it's really important that we are, you know, we don't just read the nice things and we think about what we do. I don't know, Barry, if you have thought about it. It made me think about what we've delivered and made me want to have this conversation again, because I perhaps didn't forcefully put across that I don't think they should be taking over Newcastle United, and perhaps I should have been more confrontational.
What upsets me is that the idea that is some sort of tribal thing, that there was even mention on the podcast of the London media think this. It's kind of, that's so far off the mark. I mean, Newcastle United is a great English football club. There's no sense of, oh, why didn't the London media say this when they were going to take over Manchester United? Well, that was never so far along. I mean, if that had got further along, there would have been similar. You've got to believe that's the case. I mean, once you talk yourself into believing there's a London media conspiracy against Newcastle United, you're so off the page that we can't even have a discussion. I mean, that's so wrong. I mean, the one legitimate point here is possibly the ownership of Chelsea, which I've looked back at recently and thought, wow, we really didn't understand what was going on there in 2003 when that happened. 3 years after Vladimir Putin had come into power, this new Russia. I mean, that's a really good example of something happening under your nose that probably, if it were to happen now, would draw a lot of similar kind of heat like this. The nature of that ownership is interesting, to say the least. But just because something like that's happened doesn't mean we want something else like that to happen, or that it should be something you particularly welcome. Having said that, Abramovich has been a very good club owner. If you're just a fan, he's actually been fantastic.
I'm just conscious of the fact that if you invite someone on to the podcast, you don't really then set about attacking them with cudgels, you know. But yeah, maybe we did give him a bit of an easy ride, but I don't necessarily think it was too easy.
I really like Newcastle as a club, and I'd love it to prosper in a way that didn't involve cleaning the laundry of Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's my view on it.
All right, that's about it for today. Barry, thanks for being on, Barry. You're off for three pods now, aren't you?
I'm taking a week's holidays where I can't go anywhere. I've no pub to spend my afternoons in. And yeah, I might work on my fitness, maybe.
Barney, thanks for doing that. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me on. I'm not very good at expressing myself in those sort of situations, but hopefully some form of worthwhile listening was had.
I think people will enjoy it. But if you didn't, at Barney Ronay is his Twitter handle. Right, we'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.